but I couldn't find a copy machine that works. And I couldn't find a printer that would print more than one copy. So so I'm just going to put it here. So this is just going back to the beginning. So the first lecture, we did general issues, just to give you a sense of where we're going. The second issue, I introduced the idea of gravity as a gauge theory. And as an example, we talked about De Sitter spacetime as a gauge field. And then in the last lecture, we talked about the issue of time and the example of Barber-Bertoldi theory. And I'll review it, but the key idea here was to talk about the relationship between gauge or local symmetry and constraints. And that is really, and then we had a session for the students where we talked about basic math tools, et cetera. Then today is going to be really an elaboration of this with building up some examples. So gauge symmetries. The basic thing is gauge, let me just say gauge theories from a Hamiltonian perspective. In Hamiltonian language, since I'm in the course of arguing that gravity is a gauge theory, we have to understand gauge theories. And since we want to understand quantum physics, we have to understand them in Hamiltonian language. So here, I'm going to introduce the basic ideas and then talk about some examples. Maxwell theory, abelian, Chern-Simons theory. If you don't know what Chern-Simons theory is, you will. Abelian, Chern-Simons, a theory called BF. And then Yang-Mills, and then non-abelian Chern-Simons. So that's that will probably be much of today. And then just to talk about what happens next. So with that under our belt, we then, next time, introduce the very, very key idea, which is, first of all, we'll talk more about topological field theory, having given some examples, and the idea of general relativity as a constrained version of that. So these are called topological field theories, the constrained topological field theory. And that will be the subject of the next one. And then finally, we have some perspective where we can do quantization of BF and general relativity. And that will be the basic introduction, and then continue the next time with volume, area, etc., observables. Okay. And then the next time is dynamics. Okay. And then I think then I think we'll discuss, that will be the basics, and we'll discuss where to go from there. Okay? Questions, comments? Is the speaker too loud? Yeah. Yes? That is a yes. So there's a volume control here. What? It's okay? Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. So, and I hope today is sort of the least sexy of the day, of the lectures, but I hope it will be interesting and fun. And I'm going to start with something that everybody knows something about, which is Maxwell theory. And this may be reviewed for many people, but it's important to say these things, and it's also important to get some of the technology right as we do it. In any case, it's always nice to start with something painless, because Chern-Simons theory is more interesting, more challenging. Okay. So I have a 3+1 dimensional Minkowski space-time, so this is a theory on the background. I have a vector potential, which is a one form. My coordinates are xA, which is x0, which is for time, and xI. I is 1, 2, 3 for space. The field strength. And I told this to the students. There are different notations in use, and I think the most educational thing is to be inconsistent, which I'll be anyway. So I use some combination of what Bob Wall calls abstract index notation and just index notation. That means that I write indices, but I pretend I'm doing mathematics. Okay, so this is a two form, which is dA, AB, which if you want, in all the gory detail. And I think that, we start with an action, which is an integral over time, an integral over space of FAB is a -1/4. I use signature minus plus plus plus. FAB, FCB, A to AC, A to BD. Well, that's the Minkowski metric. So I call that thing A to AB. Okay, and you will never see me, because I'm so conscious about this, you will never see me or rarely see me use an index out of natural location. And because I want to be very conscious that I'm soon going to be working in a context where there is no background metric, I resist the temptation to just raise and lower indices with the metric, because the metric is about to become an operator, and all those operations of raising and lowering indices are about to become meaningless at the classical level. But here I keep it. And to get ready to make the Hamiltonian decomposition, so this is integral d4x, just over time, -1/4. And I have minus del 0, actually, let me take that out, plus del 0 ai minus del I a 0 squared, so now I'm just squaring on that index with the 1/2, minus 1/2 fij squared, squaring on those indices. Okay. And now we make the Hamiltonian version of the theory. And I assume that everybody has done some Hamiltonian mechanics. Not everybody may have done it at the level of field theory, but it just follows along naturally. So the canonical momenta, the first thing we find is the momenta. And this is a vector density. And remember, I use a twiddle to indicate a density. And it's the variation of the action by the time derivative of the field And this is eta ij f 0 j, being completely explicit. Okay. In other words, it is del 0 a I, if I raise the index, I'll do it here, minus del I a 0. And then that's the canonical momentum for the spatial AIs. But of course, the key thing is that there is no time derivative here of a 0. And there being no time derivative of a 0, the canonical momentum for a 0 exists, but is 0. So if one defines pi 0, delta Lagrangian delta a 0 dot, this is 0. And that's the first indication that something new is happening from ordinary Hamiltonian mechanics. And I strongly recommend, I'm not going to teach the general theory of constrained systems a la Dirac, but I strongly recommend, as I said last time, reading Dirac's little book, which is in our library, about constrained systems. This is our first constraint in Maxwell theory. And the idea is that one is making a transformation from a space of coordinates and velocities to a space of coordinates and momentum, which is the phase space. And sometimes the definition, the very definition of the transformation from a theory which is a function of coordinates and velocities to coordinates and momenta, comes along with constraints. That is, not every point in the space XP corresponds here to a solution to the theory. Because for an ordinary theory which is second order, the space of coordinates and velocities are also spaces of initial data. And here we see, not every, if we go to the phase space of electrodynamics, which is the space of AI, these are functions on 3 space A0, pi I, and pi 0. If I call this the phase space, not every point in here corresponds to a solution of Maxwell's equations. And we have constraints. This is our first constraint. Okay. Now, what Dirac tells us to do when we have a constraint is the following. So Dirac says find the momenta, okay. Notice constraints, and constraints that arise in the definitions of momenta are called primary constraints. Then Dirac says, construct the Hamiltonian, which we'll do in a moment. And that gives the dynamics through the usual Poisson brackets. So we have Poisson brackets here, A, I at a point X, I, J at a point Y, is delta ij, delta 3xy. And this is a density. It's a vector density, the pi. And again, remember, the fact that pi is a vector density means there really is a two-form, pi ij, which is epsilon ijk, pi k. And because this transforms as a density, the delta function transforms as a density, as it has to, because it's an object that you integrate over. And a density is something which is well defined to integrate over. So we have the Poisson brackets. We also have Poisson brackets a0, pi0, same thing. And we find the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is the integral It's the sum over the different degrees of freedom, which in the context of the field theory is an integral over space. It's pi I a dot I, so we go p q dot minus the Lagrangian, plus pi 0 a dot 0 minus the Lagrangian. That's its definition. Notice, by the way, the pi is a density, so those integrals are well defined. And notice that the pi from varying the a with the lower index, so by varying the time derivative of the one form, you get a vector, so that there's no metric involved in the contraction of pi and a. And I won't do the calculation in front of you because I'll get all the factors of two wrong, but this becomes 1 half pi I pi, well, I'll do it once in gory detail, and then I'll just write squares, 1 half pi squared plus 1 fourth Fij squared plus, and let me notice where this comes from. Okay. When I notice that pi I is del 0 a I, and I'm lowering the index because there's a plus sign, so I can do that in the metric, minus del 0 a I. When I substitute, that means that a dot I is pi I plus del 0 a I. I'm sorry. No wonder people were looking nervous. Del I a 0. And I do that here. I do that for the a dot. And then I integrate by part. So then I get a term in the pi squared. And I get another term in the pi squared from the Lagrangian squared. But then I have another term, which is del I a 0 pi. I integrate that by parts. And I get a minus a 0 divergence of pi. And that's the Hamiltonian. Oh, and I forgot, I also have the pi 0 a dot 0. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian. Okay? Yeah?
I have a question about naming freedom indices, especially at the action. One of the very first things you wrote down. The action is the integral of a scalar, so all the a, b, c, and d's are contracted internally.
Yeah.
And then you set that equal to something with i's and j's, which are seem to be free. And so.
No, I'm just not writing it out.
So I is not contracted. It's
what I mean by a vector, say of one form squared, I mean vi, bj, delta ij. Sorry, I forgot to note that.
Okay.
Good.
So with Fij squared.
It's the same thing. Fij squared, I mean Fij, FKL, delta IK, delta JL. But what that happens to turn into is literally a sum over I less than J, Fij quantity squared. Okay. So this is the Hamiltonian as it is now. And now remember, however, that there is the constraint pi 0 equals 0. And only since that comes from the variational principle, that has to be imposed on solutions. So there's some surface here of pi 0 equals 0. And if we're not on that surface, we're at a point in the phase space that doesn't correspond to any solution of Maxwell or any initial data from Maxwell. So we have to take it into account. And of course, by taking it into account, this term is going to go away. But there's more consequences, because now I'm going to evolve So evolve means, of course, use the Hamilton's equations. So anything dot is the Poisson bracket of that with the Hamiltonian. And a question that we should ask when we impose a constraint and then we evolve is the constraint satisfied by the evolution? So even if I start from a point here where pi 0 is 0 and I evolve, I might go off the surface where pi 0 equals 0. Well, if I go off the surface where pi 0 equals 0, then I'm wandering into regions of the phase space that don't correspond to a solution of the equations of motion. Because the condition pi 0 equals 0 came from the Legendre transform from the equations of motion to the Hamiltonian theory. So I have to make sure that I evolve such that pi 0 stays 0. And that means I have to check pi 0 dot and make sure that it's equal to 0. And Dirac emphasizes that if I don't do that, I don't know that I'm going to get consistent equations. And I'm certainly not going to get equations that are the same as the Lagrangian equations of motion. So let's check that. So that's the Poisson bracket of pi 0. And it's at some point x. Let's do it at a point z, since we have an integral over x there, with the Hamiltonian. And what's going to happen? Well, the only way you're going to get a non-zero term here from those Poisson brackets is from a0, if there's an a0 anywhere. Well, there's no a0 in Fij squared. There is an explicit a0 here. So I take the Poisson bracket, and it just picks up the a0 here. So I get, and there's a minus sign from here and a minus sign from there. So I get the divergence of pi I at this point z. So I learn that pi 0 is only 0 if this object is equal to 0. And let's give this thing a name. It's called g for Gauss's law, and we set it equal to 0. So we learn that there's another constraint. So we're making a list of constraints. So we have pi 0 equals 0, and we have g is the divergence of pi equal to 0. Okay. Now, in other words, I have to be in some narrower constraint surface where pi is 0 and g is equal to 0. And, of course, these are infinite numbers of conditions, because there's one condition for every point on the manifold. Okay, now, so I do that. So I impose a second constraint. And,
just a question.
Yeah.
The second Poisson bracket. At that stage, do we impose the primary constraint because it's in 0.60?
No, the Poisson brackets come from the definition of the phase space. So, and at the moment, what we're doing is defining the Poisson brackets in the whole phase space, and then imposing constraints after that. But when we use Poisson brackets, we don't use Poisson brackets in the constraint surface. We use Poisson brackets in the whole thing. Now, there are approaches to gauge theories in which you then go down to the constraint surface, but I'm not doing that. And the reason why I'm not doing that is because generally those are mechanisms that work for linear theories and are very hard to implement for non. I mean, this is all linear, and I can maybe when I've laid the whole thing out, I can discuss how to do that. Okay. There's a notation which is useful, which is you can say the two quantities, you know, Q1 and Q2 are equal to each other with curly brackets. And that means the Q1 restricted to the constraint surface is equal to Q2 restricted to the constraint surface. That is, if you want to evaluate these quantities on the constraint surface, then there are quantities that can otherwise differ but be equal to each other. And I will use that. So for example, I mean, this term, since pi 0 is 0, and we've seen that pi 0 is always 0, this term is never comes into anything. OK. Good. Now, now we have to do it again. That is, now we should check again that G dot is equal to 0, which is the Poisson bracket, and this is at a point Z, the Poisson bracket of G and Z with the Hamiltonian. And we have to check that this is preserved under evolution. And I'll let this be an exercise that it is. Okay. And which is something you can just do in your spare time and check. So that this is consistent. What that means is we start on this constraint surface, pi 0 equals 0 and g equals 0, we stay on the constraint surface. And so Dirac says, construct the Hamiltonian, check consistency of constraints, and keep going. And two things can happen. Either the constraints close, as these have, or the theory is inconsistent. If you started with inconsistent Lagrangian or inconsistent, you know, something that had no solution, this could just keep going on forever. But sooner or later, this has to close, and it has closed. So we're done with the Hamiltonian theory, but let me now just make some comments about what we have. And I'm going to come back to, because in the different theories we're going to look at, we'll see there are different cases for what can happen to get the constraints to close. In this case, it's very simple, so I don't have to put a heavy methodology on the discussion. Okay. So one thing is that A0 plays no role in the theory. So a thing that you can certainly do is you can certainly restrict to just the ai and the pi I, because the A0 plays no role and pi 0 is always 0. So that's commonly done. By the way, the pi's are sometimes called E's for electric fields. When we do that, however, we need the imposition of this constraint. So if you want to do really what Zhao was suggesting, which is sort of get rid of the pi 0, you can get rid of the pi 0. And you can get rid of the A0 as a dynamical variable. It doesn't evolve. It has no time derivative. But you need something to sit here. So typically, if you do that, we would write a Hamiltonian, which looks like 1 half pi squared plus 1 fourth Fij squared, and just invent a Lagrange multiplier of lambda for g. And this is the form that we usually study it in. So you can, if it's so trivial, it's a coordinate or momenta is just equal to 0, you can just set it equal to 0, as long as you're also getting rid of the thing which is conjugate to it. Okay, so this is the theory that we want to go ahead and study quantum mechanically. Let me just, I'm not going to do the quantum mechanics today because I'm just going through these classical examples. But let me note that there are now several things we could do to proceed. One of them is, in this case, we could solve the constraints. And if we solve the constraints, we first of all solve for divergence of pi equals 0. And that such pi are called transverse degrees of freedom. And that's what people commonly do. And then they would also have to restrict to transverse degrees of freedom for the A's. And that gets you to the usual physical degrees of freedom. It's not what I'm going to do, but I just want to notice, because that's what usually is done in quantum field theory textbooks at this point. Why I'm not going to be following that is because for the interesting cases that we're interested in, especially for topological field theory and quantum gravity, nobody knows how to solve the constraints. Obviously, if you could, with my picture, if you could get down to coordinates on the constraint surface plus Poisson brackets on the constraint surface, you'd rather do that. And then you could just deal with that system. But in most cases of interest, apart from linear theory, it's too hard to do that. Nobody knows how to do that. So instead, there are a number of alternatives. Some defined only in perturbation theory, some not. The general alternative I'm going to be talking about mostly at the beginning is called Dirac quantization. And Dirac's quantization says quantize the whole phase space . So that would mean, in this case, for example, psi of the vector potentials, wave functions of the vector potentials, and impose the constraints as operators. And we discussed this last time with respect to Barber-Bertoldi theory. So we find an operator for G on psi of AI. And we evaluate that. So that's what I will be doing to look ahead when we quantize. I need one more thing. I realize I just said this out of order. I need an interpretation of what the constraints do. Because the constraint stays within the Hamiltonian. So the evolution involves a piece involving G, because it was in the Hamiltonian there, and it stays in the Hamiltonian, even though it's zero on the constraint surface. So what is the role of the constraint being here in the Hamiltonian? Now, with the Barber-Bertoldi theory last time, we had a Hamiltonian which was nothing but a constraint. This is a little bit less radical of a situation, but there's still a constraint in the Hamiltonian. So what does it mean? Well, so let's examine it. So let's, for example, talk about A dot I. So A dot I is, at some point Z, is a Poisson bracket of AI at the point Z with the Hamiltonian. And there are two pieces of interest. There is the piece which is pi squared. And the piece which is pi squared, you won't be surprised. Should I do it just to make sure we do the whole thing once? So this is the Poisson bracket. I'm going to pull the integral out, d3x, of ai of z. And there's a term of interest which is a half pi squared of x. And then there's another term, which is lambda times g. So there are two terms in the Poisson bracket. Well, the first one is the a with the pi is a delta function, leaves over a pi, but there are two, so the square comes down and cancels the 1/2. And so this first term is just nothing but pi at the same point z. That's the Poisson bracket of a with the integral of pi squared over all the positions. Okay, is that clear? Again, it's in two steps. The Poisson bracket is a pi at x times the delta of x and z, sorry, z and x. You integrate over the x, and it becomes pi of z. But then there's the second term, which I'm going to call delta lambda of a, where what I mean by that is delta lambda of a at z is the Poisson bracket of ai with g. What I mean by lambda being a Lagrange multiplier is that it's not in the phase space. It has no Poisson bracket with anybody, which was the case if we could have just left it there as a0, and an a0 has zero Poisson bracket with ai or phi i. So what is this? I mean, a dot is pi is conventional. What is this extra term? So I'm going to compute it. I'll come back to that. So delta lambda ai at z is, and actually, let me put the integral back in, d3x, and then let me multiply times the lambda of x there. So this is the integral d3x, lambda of x, and the Poisson bracket of ai of z with the divergence of pi I at x. And we faced something like this last time, but let me just take you through the steps. And I'll just do it down here, and then I'll put the answer over there. So this derivative here is a d by dxi. Since it's a d by dxi, because it acts on that index, on that dependence there, it can be pulled outside. So it's the same thing as integral d3x lambda of x del by del x I times the Poisson bracket of ai of z pi. And I realize I have too many indices. Let me call this one k, pi k of x. Okay, so now I pulled it outside. And with appropriate boundary conditions, namely lambda being zero on the boundary. So let me assume that lambda at the boundary at infinity is zero. Then I can integrate by parts. So this is minus integral d3x del k lambda at x times the Poisson bracket of ai of z pi k of x, okay? And now I just evaluate that because I know what the Poisson bracket is. The delta of the indices tells me that the I is the k, so the I goes over here, and I have a delta function of z and x. So in other words, this is integral d3x del I of lambda at x times the delta function of z and x. And so I integrate over x, and it tells me that x is z, and this is just d by dzi lambda at z. So this is del I lambda at z. Okay. Now, what is that? That's just a gauge transformation that says that the variation, that says, in other words, A dot, as A evolves in time, there's a piece which is proportional to pi, which is its momenta, and then there's another piece which is a gauge transformation, which just adds the derivative of lambda, which is an arbitrary function, it's a Lagrange multiplier. So what we see is that the effect of having the constraint in the Hamiltonian is that there's a free gauge transformation. As the A is evolving, it's free to make a gauge transformation as it goes on. And since lambda is an arbitrary function, it's free to make a gauge transformation as it goes. And is this a problem? Well, it's not a problem as long as we remember that in the end, the observables have to be gauge invariant. So this is something which isn't going to trouble us at all. It just means that there's a gauge transformation as we go. Let me see if I can. But it does mean the following. Let me sort of redraw my picture here. So let's forget pi zero. And so we just have this constraint surface, g equals zero. And so we start at a point, and we evolve. We start at a point on the constraint surface, and we evolve. And there's actually many different places we can go, depending on lambda. So as I change, in other words, as I'm evolving, along different curves depending on lambda, the gauge invariant quantities, namely the Fij, which is the curl of A, or it's D, that has a well-defined value at all times that doesn't depend on lambda. But the A itself can be anything. And so what's happening is that the G is generating gauge transformations, and we just live with that. And we see actually an important lesson, which is that the constraints, some constraints, and I'll come back later and tell you which, so some constraints generate gauge transformations. And they're just there along for the ride. Okay. So I don't know how many of you have seen, I mean, you've all studied Maxwell theory in different incarnations. Now, how many of you have seen it at the Hamiltonian level in all the intricacies of it? But it's a nice example. Now, for example, some people would want a gauge fix. And to gauge fix means to pick out one of these particular trajectories, to put on some condition on the initial conditions to get rid of the G in the Hamiltonian and put a condition on the initial condition such that there's a unique evolution which respects some additional condition, which is a gauge condition. But from the point of view of physics, it's not essential to do that. This just goes along for the ride. Okay.
Question. How much of this survives throughout the sources?
Everything.
Everything goes through.
Everything, yeah. As long as the sources are also gauge invariant. Right. Okay. So last thing to say about this, and then I'm going to change examples. The last thing to say is that, which, let me put over there. Again, something you can check is that delta lambda of pi is zero. So that the pi's are not, pi I, are not affected by gauge transformations. Which makes sense because secretly the pi's, remember from the definition, the pi's are what we usually call the electric field, and we know that those are gauge invariant. So we get that coming out. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Now I want to discuss another example, which may be less familiar. And again, it may be familiar to some people, but not the brutal detail of the Hamiltonian theory. And that's abelian Chern-Simons theory. Do I really? Yeah, I think this will work. Okay, and I hope I get this right. I think I'll get it right. So now our manifold is some three-dimensional manifold, and I'm going to pick it particularly to be of the form, so 3D of the form of sigma cross R, where R is going to play the role of the time coordinate, and sigma is a compact two-manifold, and is no metric. Okay? And the action is the only thing, the only three-form, and I have the same fields. So I have the same one form on the manifold. And the action is, now, this is something that I haven't taught, but I hope people know and know how to look it up. An action, in the absence of a metric, is an integral of a density. And that's also an integral of a top form, in this case, a three form. And there is, as far as I know, unless I forget something, only one three form we can write given a one form, and the derivative operator, which is all that we have, is the notion of derivatives. So what this is the integral of A wedge dA. That's the action. So this is there's no metric, there's no Poincaré invariance, no Lorentz invariance. It's just that. If I introduce the epsilon symbol, epsilon ABC, such that epsilon 0, 1, 2 is plus 1, and it's totally anti-symmetric, then this is also the integral of epsilon ABC, AA derivative of B, AC. And we're going to derive, now I could tell you by staring at the action some properties, like is it gauge invariant, is it diffeomorphism invariant, and so forth. But rather than doing that, we're just going to start to analyze and derive all the properties. Okay. So we want to distinguish time from space again. So I'm going to distinguish, my indices A are going to be distinguished 0 and I, which now is 1, 2. So they're now two spatial dimensions. And the action can be written as epsilon ij. And because there are two places that these have to be all different. So one of them is a time coordinate. So here's the possibilities. The time coordinate is here. So this is A0 times del I AJ. And that's anti-symmetrized. So that's half of the F, the field strength. Notice that there's only one. I do need some more blackboard here. I think I. is only one F. So the magnetic fields have only one component. So there's only one F, which is F12, which sometimes I'm going to call F, which is del 1 A2 minus del 2 A1. So then the time derivative can be here. So it's 0, 1, 2. So that is AJ del 0 AI. And then the time derivative, the time component can be here, which is AI del J A0. So that's the action. Let me notice that I can integrate by parts because the manifold in space is compact. So I can integrate by parts. That puts the derivative here. And I missed the sign. So let me give myself that sign. Let me just make sure. 0ij.
No, if you do the integration.
By parts, I get a sign. Thank you. Thank you. So you get two of these. Okay, so now let's follow Dirac's prescription. So let's find the momenta. So first let's find the momenta pi I. Again, that's the derivative of the action delta A dot I. And that picks up this term. So this is, say, at a point Z. And that is epsilon ij aj at the point z. And that is a very interesting relation. It says, if you like, that pi 1 is a 2. And pi 2 is minus a 1. And this is a constraint, because it's a relationship between a momenta and a coordinates. So if we're going to start listing the constraints, I'm going to put them over here. So we're doing Abelian-Chern-Simon, and we're listing constraints. And these are primary constraints, so I'll call them pi, and they're pi I minus epsilon ij aj, and they're equal to 0. There are two such constraints. And then, yes?
How is it a constraint in the definition?
So a primary constraint is a, when you define the canonical momenta, if there is a relationship between momenta and fields, momenta and coordinates, that don't involve the time derivative, so it has to be true on the initial data surface, then we call that a primary constraint. Okay? So before we had pi 0 equals 0, now we have pi 1 is a 2, and pi 2 is minus a 1. Okay. And then we also have, we can look for pi 0. And again, there's no time derivative of pi 0. So pi 0 equals 0, and that's another constraint. We can just call this p 0 with pi 0 equals 0. So this is different. Before, we had four A's and four pi's, and we found one primary constraint. Now we have three a's and three pi's. This is per point of space, and we find three primary constraints, so quite a lot of constraints. So it's quite different. Let me also notice that what this implies. What this implies, I mean, the Poisson brackets are the same as I have there, except now, now let me just put a 2 here, and then they're the same as they were before. But that implies, if I use the constraint, that implies that AI, let me just say it's different, A1 of X, A2 of Y equals delta 2 XY. Actually, if I want to write the coordinate invariant way, I should put epsilon 1, 2 there. So the A's don't commute with each other. The two different A's don't commute with each other. And so it's different than Maxwell theory. Okay, so so those are the constraints. Let's look at what the Hamiltonian is. Right, so the next step is to find the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is the integral of pi I a dot I plus pi 0 a dot 0 minus the Lagrangian. And the Lagrangian has a term which is a 0 times pi times f, what I just had before, is epsilon. And then there is the term here, which is already pi a dot. So the pi a dots cancel, and all we get from here is a 0 f, and then there's still the term in pi 0 a dot 0. And rather than the usual thing where we get the pi squared kind of thing by substituting a dot for pi doesn't work the same way here. Instead, what happens is that because pi is like a, but pi is also the component of b0 ai here, this term in the Lagrangian cancels this term, and we just get this. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian, integral v3x. Okay. Now, let's follow the next step of Dirac, which is check the consistency of the constraints. So let me try the same thing. Let's start with pi 0. Pi 0 dot is a Poisson bracket of pi 0 with h. This is at some point z. Z, it's the same calculation as before, except that there's an a 0 hanging out here, and it's related, it's multiplied by f. So this is equal to f, which is 0. And there's some factor of 4 or 2 or something that I'm suppressing. Okay. So we have another constraint. The constraint f, which is del 1 a2 minus del 2 a1. And I'll just call that f is equal to 0. Okay. So the magnetic field, there's one component of the magnetic field in two dimensions, and it's constrained to be equal to 0. Okay, now in addition So, and then we have to check F dot is the Poisson bracket of F with the Hamiltonian, and I'll let you check that that's equal to zero. Okay, so, and we're not done yet, but now, I mean, the theory, the fact that there's one component per point of the magnetic field and it's equal to zero is really reducing the degrees of freedom quite a bit. But let me remind you that, in fact, I didn't say, because we didn't take the time to look at it, but let me take the time to look at the equations of motion. And the equations of motion you can get, I'll also make this an exercise, from the Lagrangian, and it just says that all three components of zero, of F are zero. So in fact, the field equations are that all components of the field strength are zero. So the electric, what you would normally call the electric fields and the magnetic fields are all zero. And so we're getting, as a constraint, one of those. And then we'll think in a little bit about what's happening to the others. Okay. So we should not be so shocked to see that. We have still these constraints to worry about. Okay. What about these constraints? And what I'm going to, there are different ways to treat those. Let me just make it as a kind of exercise that you can check. So we want to check P1 at a point X with P2 at a point Y. Check those Poisson brackets. And that's just an exercise in getting the signs right. And unless I'm wrong, that's twice delta xy. And so we have a new thing happening, which is that we have two constraints that are commuting to a number whose Poisson bracket gives us a number. And so Dirac makes a distinction in which he divides constraints into two groups. Constraints are second class. So an algebra of constraints is second class if they don't close. And they're first class if the algebra does close. And there's actually another category, which is business class, which is where they close, but coefficients are degrees of freedom. Now, this is a second class case, and that's the case that you can't easily quantize. And so, for these cases, one does do whenever one can what Zhao suggests, which is just solve them. So the best advice when you're faced with these kinds of things is solve them, because they're a mess to try to make sense of quantum mechanically, because to try to make sense of something like this is an operator equation. And if you don't believe me, we can see some examples. Of course, this one is just linear. And by solve it, it just means that we eliminate pi 1, which is a 2, and pi 2, which is minus a 1. And we just go down to the phase space, which is a 1 and a 2. And we then define the Poisson bracket to be this. Okay. So that's what we'll do at this stage.
Sorry, what happened to pi dot electron zero?
We haven't done it yet. But it's pi is pi I is not. Oh, sorry. Thank you. I skipped a step. You're right.
So zero.
No. Let me think of the right way to say this. I don't want to do the math, but let me say what would have happened and leave it as an exercise. What would have happened is that, or what is true, is that pi I dot Poisson bracket pi I, the Hamiltonian, is not zero, and instead would introduce more trouble with more constraints. I think, I should say I haven't checked this recently because I forgot to do this while preparing. And therefore, it's a very good idea just to get rid of it and go down to the space of its solutions. But actually, why don't we check? I want to check it real time in front of you. It may be that it's zero on, let me just be embarrassed and say I forgot to prepare that. Okay. Good. Anyway, having gotten rid of that beast, then the theory that we're left with is a theory where the phase space is just A1 and A2. The Poisson bracket is that, and the Hamiltonian is just an integral. Again, we've gotten rid of A0, we get rid of pi 0. It's just an integral d3x lambda f. Yeah.
Just a question concerning pi dot still.
Yes, we can do it if you
have
time. No,
do it. And just because in principle, we will end up with a closed system or not.
I'm feeling embarrassed. So let's maybe do it during the break. Okay, let's check it. Okay. I think I misspoke, and I think it is just zero. But I think that there isn't enough complexity for anything else to happen. Okay. So this is the Hamiltonian. And F, so this is a case like the case of that we discussed before, like the Barber-Bertotti theory, where the whole Hamiltonian is just proportional to a constraint. So the Hamiltonian is zero. And what does F do? So now it's interesting to say, I mean, the only interesting thing to compute is what happens to AI what happens to AI when we evolve it at a point. So it's AI at a point Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian. And that's just the integral d3x lambda at x, the Poisson bracket of ai with f. And by, am I writing too small? Can everybody see that? Or should I write a little bit bigger for the back? Okay. And let's do that in the little space that we have here.
Shouldn't the integration variables be something else? Maybe like a different variable?
Yes, it should. Thank you. Well, I have x. Sorry, let me make this z. Thank you. Ai of z, f of x. So just before I get my hands dirty, let me think about, look, the easiest thing to do is just, let's just do A1, I just don't, you know, I can have epsilons around, but let me just do A1, and so what I want to compute is integral B3x, lambda of x. And now I have the Poisson bracket of A1 of x with derivative A1, derivative, I'm sorry, of z, d by d x1 of A2 minus d by d x2 of A1. And what happens? The non-zero Poisson bracket is between A1 and A2. So we don't care about this term. Then there's a derivative, which is a d by dx1. And now we know what to do. We pull it out. We integrate by parts. Okay? Then we get a delta function. We integrate over the delta function. So lo and behold, this is nothing other than minus d by d z1 of lambda, which is just a gauge transformation again. So all that happens when you evolve in this theory is that A1 and A2 evolve under, they just gauge transform. The lambda is free function, and it tells you how to gauge transform, and all that evolution does is it makes a gauge transform. Which is not surprising because f is zero, and it starts zero, so the only thing that can happen is you can just start from some zero magnetic field configuration to some other zero magnetic field configuration under a gauge transformation. So that's all that happens. And we see again that the constraint is generating, notice in Maxwell, the Gauss's law generates the gauge transformation. Here, the F generates the gauge transformation. But it's the only thing that can happen. So there's just a gauge transformation. Finally, you can, let me just say one more thing, and then we should take a break. The theory is the theory, and I said this last time, but let me just say it to rub it in precisely. Is the theory totally trivial? Is the theory totally trivial? And the theory is not totally trivial if, and I'm just looking for a blackboard to put this on. There's one good. Can I get one there? So what about some observables? Well, there are no local observables. Yes?
Why is the Hamiltonian still integral over three dimensions?
Why is the what?
Hamiltonian still integral over three dimensions.
Because I'm dumb. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So there are no local observables. And so you can show that, I mean, there can't be, you know. This is Maxwell theory. We have two spatial dimensions. We have two components of A, but their d of them is zero. And any other derivative you add will be zero. I mean, a local observable is some function of the field that points and derivatives of points. And the only gauge invariant function is f, which is zero, and all its derivatives are zero. So there is no local observable. But there are global observables if pi 1, and for people who don't know what this is, I'll define it in a minute, if pi 1 of sigma is not trivial. So what that means, pi 1 is the maps of circles into the manifold. So it means it's not simply connected. And let's take an example. Let's take sigma is equal to the two-dimensional torus. So the two-dimensional torus is a square with this identified with this, and this edge identified with this edge. It's not simply connected because I can draw a curve like that. Let me call that curve alpha. And it's a closed curve because this point is the same as that point. And that can't be contracted to a point. And let's work out, I mentioned this before, but let's work out A of alpha, by which I define integral of the warm form A around the closed curve alpha. And that can be non-zero even if A is, even if F, the D of A or the curl of A is everywhere zero. That can be not zero. Now, one can actually, there's actually more. This has some properties. One of them is that it's gauge invariant. How do we know that? That's because, did I do this last time, but I may have done it in a session just for the students. Did I discuss the gauge invariance of this already? I did. No? Yes? Okay.
In the second part of the first.
Okay, so let me just spell this, because this is something we're going to use all the time. What this means is I have a curve. It means there's a, I can choose an arbitrary parameter S along the curve. And then I have AI of S are the points for every S in the manifold. And I also have a tangent vector given by A dot I of S, which is alpha, D alpha ds. And so what I mean by the line integral, to put it in all detail, is AI at the point alpha of S, alpha dot I of S ds. And one property that this has is that it's reparametrization invariant, which means that if I choose a different S, it's the same function. The way to see that is that this is d alpha ds, and if I change the S's to any other parameter, S prime, which is a function of S, the derivatives of that cancel. So it's reparametrization invariant. It's gauge invariant. Let's check it. Delta A of alpha is the integral of d lambda around alpha, which is the integral of del I of lambda alpha dot I ds. But this is the same thing as the integral of d by dt of lambda at alpha of t dt. And that, since it's a closed curve, is zero, because it's an integral of a derivative around the closed curve. So it's gauge invariant. It's also a constant of motion. Why do we know it's a constant of motion? Because the effect of evolution is to make a gauge transformation. So since evolution is just a gauge transformation, and that's gauge invariant, it's a constant of motion. So it's a constant of motion. And It also has another important property, which is the following. Supposing I move alpha to some other curve, alpha prime, smoothly. So supposing I take, and I think I need more space here. There's a notion of a homotopy of curves. So I have here alpha, and I have here another curve, alpha prime, which is homotopic. That means that I can smoothly go from alpha to alpha prime. Then it's an easy fact that A of alpha prime is equal to A of alpha. How do I show that? I compute A of alpha minus A of alpha prime. And there's a closed region here, R, whose boundary is alpha and alpha prime. And so this by, is it Stokes' theorem? I always forget the name of the theorem. Stokes' theorem is the integral d2x in the region R of f, which is the curl of A, which is 0.
So presumably you need to close it, and this proof gets to go back and forth along the edge.
No, because you should remember this. It doesn't matter yet. I mean, you can go up and down, and it doesn't matter. Because that has 0, that contributes 0 to. Yeah. Okay. So that means that if I define, let me define a bracket for alpha to equal the homotopy class of the loop, then it means that A of alpha is actually just a function of its homotopy class. Now, in the torus, there are only two generators of the homotopy in the two-dimensional torus. I can go around there, or I can go around there, let me call that beta. So, and there's nothing else. I could go twice around alpha, but then that observable is just twice alpha. So, I mean, it's also everything, since everything is nice and abelian, A of n times going around alpha, I guess we would write that as alpha to the n, is the same thing as n A of alpha. So that does going more than once around the same loop doesn't give you any more information. So for the case of the torus, there are 2 degrees of freedom. I can go around the alpha loop or go around the beta loop. So for torus T2, there's just A of alpha and A of beta, and that's it. That's the physical degrees of freedom. Now, there's one very nice thing. So if you like, where we are is I have completely the gauge invariant time independent degrees of freedom in A of alpha and A of beta. So I have 2 degrees of freedom. And you might ask, do they form a phase space all by themselves, since those are the only measurable quantities? I haven't really proven it to you, but I think it's plausible that those are the only 2 measurable quantities. So let's see, do they form a phase space? Let's compute the Poisson bracket of A of alpha with A of beta. And this is an interesting little calculation to do. Let me, I'll need some room here, so if you mind, can I take some room for myself here? The answer is going to be very simple, but it's an instructive calculation to do. So if I write out in detail, then I have some, I pick one alpha and one beta. It doesn't matter which representative of alpha and beta I pick one of each. I have a coordinate s here and t along here. So this is the Poisson bracket of integral ds a I as a function of alpha of s alpha dot I of s Poisson bracket integral dt a j beta of t beta dot j of t. And so I want to take the Poisson bracket of all that stuff. So let me pull everything outside I can possibly pull outside. There's an integral ds, an integral dt. There's an alpha dot I of s, an alpha dot j of t, and this Poisson bracket of ai of alpha of s, I'm sorry, beta. Aj of beta of t. Okay, now I can do this several different ways, but remember this is my Poisson bracket, so what that really means is that Ai of x, aj of y, Poisson bracket, is there's an epsilon, ij, delta 2, xy. So let me just use that. So that's an integral ds, an integral dt, alpha dot I of s, beta dot j of t, epsilon ij, delta 2, of alpha of s theta of t. Does anybody know what that is? Okay, well, that's equal to 1. And let me demonstrate it to you. I think I went longer than I wanted to, but let me just give that there's brutal arguments and simple arguments. Okay, here's the simple argument. This is all coordinate independent. There's no background metric. There's no structure at all. So let me just choose coordinates such that I use the coordinate s here and the coordinate t here. Okay, let me just choose those coordinates. In that case, alpha I of s is just s0, and beta I of t is just 0t. Okay? Therefore, the alpha dot 1 is 1, the beta dot 2 is 1, this is 1, and the whole thing reduces to the integral ds dt delta of s. Let me choose where the beta line is to be s equals 0 and where the alpha line is to be t equals 0. And then it's just delta of s and 0 and delta of t and 0. Okay. So it's just equal to 1. Okay, so this is equal to 1, and that's your phase space. So in the end, when you solve abelian transignment theory on a torus, it's just a two-dimensional phase space, okay, with canonical Poisson brackets. There's one position and there's one momenta, and they have Poisson bracket one. And that's the solution of Abelian Schoensheimer theory on a torus. Okay, 2 degrees of freedom. So, any questions?
Couldn't you just do the trick of making it a surface term? Or sometimes people do that.
Which a surface term?
Well, in this case, it doesn't work for the surface.
Oh, you mean up a four-dimensional thing?
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, if this three-manifold is the boundary of a four-manifold, okay. But I'm not particular. I don't particularly need that. Okay. So yeah, I mean, this is an example of a topological field theory. It's a theory which doesn't depend on any metric, so it's both background independent. I didn't show that it's diffeomorphism invariant. I will go on and show when we want to talk about that it is diffeomorphism invariant. It's gauge invariant, and we solved it completely. It's a very boring theory, but it has two canonically conjugate degrees of freedom. So the entire quantum mechanics, and I'll say this, and then I'll really quit. The entire quantum mechanics is that the wave functions are functions of A of, say, alpha, period. That's the quantum mechanics. And A of beta is minus IH bar d by d a of alpha. And that's the quantum mechanics. But nothing evolves in time. It's just quantum mechanics of a single particle. OK. Why don't we take a 15-minute break and then come back. And then I forget what's next on our list. BF theory.